All right. Good morning, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalk. We're meeting on the 12th floor of the Capitol today for our regular scheduled commission meeting. It is Wednesday, January 29th, approximately 10 a.m. And barring any special circumstances, this will be our last meeting in January. Commission last week held a CO2 symposium that we might talk about towards the end of the meeting today. Yesterday, we were in Watford City for hearings dealing with two 45-megawatt gas peaker plants for Basin Electric as they figure out what they're going to do to meet their demand. McKenzie Electric was there, talked quite a bit about their needs, so I look forward to the work session and discussion on that case. And they also brought up the importance of the pending case in front of us of the 345 KV line from the ABS to around the Tioga area. So I anticipate those decisions coming very quickly. We need to make some decisions in the next couple months on those. And my review of the record and the transmission line is I think we have pretty much everything we need. So we've got a work session that we're going to be scheduling today. We had one scheduled, but we needed to push it back to get some more information. But the draft EIS is out on the 345 KV, so we can look through that, and I look forward to that discussion. Other than that, I'm just today's agenda. Not a lot of motions on there, but as always, they're very important. And as soon as our meeting is done, I hope to drop down to the Industrial Commission's 11:30 meeting to see what they have about the flaring task force. So I don't have anything else. Randy, do you have anything?
Just to add a little bit to what you already hit on, I think the last couple weeks since we met have been really interesting and informative. Our symposium last Wednesday, I know I learned a great deal from it, and the not only the details of what's going on, but the importance of what's going on with the EPA and their climate change initiatives. And then that hearing yesterday, I couldn't help but think a couple times during it that it's almost becoming routine for projects like this. And 15 years ago, if there had been a project proposed that was over $100 million because there was enough activity that additional generation was needed, that would have been the number one focus of pretty much all the press activity for probably weeks. And here it's just sort of another day in the life right now. So interesting change, but it was a good hearing, and we have a lot of good things happening here.
Thank you, Commissioner. Bishop Dorchak?
I'll just build on the carbon discussion a little bit. I also I've heard back from lots of people appreciating the fact that we held that symposium and got that discussion on the table. And I couldn't help but realize again yesterday how much of an impact these rules and potential regulations have every day in the working lives of our electric providers in the state. The Lonesome Creek project is had to consider whether or not they would be able to comply with potential new carbon rules in the selection of their technology. And that's an important factor for all these projects moving forward, and something that I'll be asking about on all of them, because the costs of going back and trying to comply after the fact are probably going to be even worse for consumers. So, again, this carbon issue is a very important policy matter that is going to have an impact on every single electric customer in this country and in this state. And I urge our citizens to pay attention to it and know what it is, and notify and let their elected leaders know how they feel about it. That's it.
Fair enough. Julie set it up, but one of the things we're going to talk about in discussion is what the commission is going to do now that we've had this symposium. So I would say at a minimum, we're going to be refiling EPA comments, and then I think we'll decide whether we're going to try to file them with other state agencies, with other states, but definitely we're going to put our thoughts together and get a document that goes to the EPA, and I'm sure we'll copy the delegation on it. But in discussions we've had with other states, there's certainly a willingness from, to throw out a few, South Dakota, Wyoming, Oklahoma, they share, I think, similar viewpoints of the North Dakota Commission. So.
You know, and I couldn't help but last night I didn't listen to the President's State of the Union speech, but I've read about it and know that it was really focused on policies that he can impact himself and kind of outside of congressional action, realizing that he's probably not going to be able to convince a majority of Congress to go along with what he wants to do. And here's a prime example of it, a carbon policy that he is implementing unilaterally from the executive branch with very little consideration to the policymakers in this country.
Absolutely. Okay, anything else? All right, well, there's a few items on consent. I would move passage of the items on consent.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. Okay, I have two items today. Item BK1. I move the commission adopt the amended order on eligible telecommunication carrier designation to designate Nexus Communication, Inc. as an eligible telecommunication carrier throughout all telephone exchanges in North Dakota, including tribal lands, for the purpose of receiving federal universal service support for low-income consumers. Case number PU 13-98.
Second.
Thank you, Julie. In February of last year, 2013, Nexus filed an application to have designation as an ETC to provide lifeline-only services. And their initial request was for in areas served by Quest Corporations and SRT, excluding tribal lands. So the commission had numerous work sessions on that, and that was, I think, the one we first developed the revised certification for the company. And so in the process of getting the revised certification signed by the company amended their application that they now want to serve the entire state, including tribal areas. So basically, we followed through the process in December. The commission issued a notice of opportunity for hearing on the revised application. Really, we had the work sessions initially and thought that was a good idea. This just basically opens up to the entire state, including tribal lands, so I certainly support this amended order.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. Item BK2. I move the commission issue a notice opportunity for hearing concerning Tempo Telecom LLC's application to be designated as an eligible carrier for the purpose of receiving federal universal service support for Lifeline Services, case number PU 14-34.
Second.
In January of this year, Tempo Telecom, owned by Birch Equity Partners, a Georgia company, filed an application to receive USF funds for low-income consumers. They would like to provide service in North Dakota wire carriers currently served by Sprint. So this is in the Sprint area. We have this motion today sets up comments and requests for hearing must be received by close of business on March 18th, 2014. If the commission deems the hearing is not appropriate, we can decide this at an informal or if we receive no request for hearing. So once again, I think this order is in order. This motion is in order.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Darrell. Okay, that concludes the items in my portfolio today. Commissioner Chrisman.
Okay, RC1, I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-13-843, granting the request of TYR Wood Products Incorporated of Portland, Oregon, to operate as a roving grain buyer in North Dakota.
Second.
A little background in this, the TYR Wood Products filed a license application to operate as a roving grain buyer in the state. They recently added food products to their business, focusing on wholesale shipments of food and egg products, both domestically and for export. They estimated they will purchase 50,000 bushels of grain in North Dakota during the first year in operation and filed a corresponding $50,000 surety bond. Statutory compliance has been met, and staff recommends that a roving grain buyer license be issued.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay, and on the flip side of the grain business. RC2, I move the commission file with Burley County District Court the report and recommendation of trustee recommending that the commission pay all valid claims together with the corresponding motion to approve report and recommendation of trustee, require deposit of bond proceeds, approve payment, and discharge trustee and related documents. I further move that once the report and recommendation is approved by the district court, the licensing director be authorized to pay all valid claims as soon as possible in Mitchell Feeds Incorporated, Roving Grain Buyer Insolvency, case number GE-11-51.
Second. Commissioner Christman, I'd also like to move a substitute motion this morning for consideration by my colleagues. And a substitute motion would be to pay only those claims arising within the effective period of the bond in Mitchell Feeds, Inc., Roving Grain Buyer Insolvency Case Number G-11-51. And I would read the full motion if I can get a second.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
Darrell, give me the parliamentary procedures here, refresher one more time to make sure we're following this all correctly.
Okay, we have a substitute motion. We would vote on the substitute motion.
Do we go through discussion on the first motion before we have the substitute? That's the question that I have.
That's a good question. I think either way would be...
Either way, so it's a strictly...
work, yeah.
Okay. And whatever Commissioner Christman prefers, if he wants to go through his and then consider. But we have to have a we can't vote on the first one until we... consider the second one.
I think it should be the chairman's prerogative which order that is, but if he's weighing in the portfolio holder's thoughts on it, I guess I would be fine with going ahead and listening and voting on this the alternative motion first, and then we can...
All right, I will second Commissioner Fedorchak's motion.
So if I can read the full motion, I move the commission file the Burley County District Court, file with Burley County District Court the report and recommendation of trustee recommending that the commission pay all valid claims arising during the period in which the bond was effective, together with the corresponding motion to approve report and recommendation of trustee, require deposit of bond proceeds, approve payment and discharge trustee and related documents. I further move that once the report and recommendation is approved by the district court, the licensing director be authorized to pay the claims as soon as possible in Mitchell Feeds, Inc., Roving Grain Buyer Insolvency Case Number GE-11-51. And I have copies of this. It's exactly the same, only...
We can't do that yet.
Yeah, that's the motion, though.
That's the motion. We still have to work on the substitute motion. We have a motion and a second and a substitute. Is there any discussion on the substitute entertainment?
There's a substitute. Yeah, I have some thoughts I wanted to share. So I'm proposing the commission, as trustee in this matter, use bond proceeds, which are the sum total of trust assets, to pay only the claims covered by the time period of the bond. The sad and very unfortunate reality in this case is that bond proceeds, and therefore trust assets, are woefully inadequate to cover the losses, $70,000 to cover claims exceeding $1 million. I ate an orange for breakfast this morning, and this analogy struck me. If the producer's losses represent the entire orange, what we are debating today is the difference between receiving zero, one, or maybe at most two slices of the orange. When dividing up such a small amount, I think it becomes even more important to ask and determine who should be at the table. So I look to the law and to commission practice to guide me. The law says that liability on a bond stems from when the breach occurs. Each contract that farmers held with Mitchell in this case stated that title for the grain transferred on delivery and payment was due 10 days after delivery and grading. Staff used these dates as the default or breach dates to determine which claims arose within the bond period and are therefore entitled to coverage by the bond and which claims arose outside the bond period. In addition to this legal guidance, commission policies and practice have been to urge, admonish, advise, encourage, and instruct producers that they are not protected if they are doing business with an unlicensed, unbonded company. These warnings are in our materials, on our website, and emphasized by staff in individual conversations with producers and in public presentations. For these reasons, because of the legal guidance on bond liability and because of commission policy and practice, I believe we should pay only those claims that arose during the time period of the bond. That said, this case and the recently resolved Anderson Seed insolvency, for which we recently provided a report to the judge, reveal several important things that demand our attention. First, farming is a dynamic, rapidly changing industry. I have serious concerns that our licensing and bonding program hasn't kept pace with the changes of this industry. Bond levels are often terribly inadequate to provide the kind of protection I think producers believe they have. The three of us have talked about this. We've discussed some potential solutions, and this case increases my determination to address these issues with producers, commodity groups, and grain dealers. We need to revisit our bonding levels that were established in law in 1999, and we must address some of the shortfalls that exist, especially in the areas of roving grain buyers, specialty crops, and processors. Second, the Commission needs to evaluate all the tools that are at our disposal through laws and rules to help prevent these kinds of situations, whether it's through stricter review of licenses and license renewals, enhanced review of the required monthly reports, or tougher enforcement of existing laws and rules such as conversion of scale tickets. And third, we need to double down on awareness. This is a partnership between the producers, the grain dealers, and the PSC. Producers play a key role and ultimately can provide their greatest protection by scrutinizing those people with whom they are doing business. But we also have a role to play in licensing, setting appropriate bond levels, and make it easier for producers to do their research. We already provide copies of licenses for grain dealers to hang in their businesses or carry in their truck. We provide a daily updated list of licensed dealers on our website. I've asked staff to take the next step of providing a wallet-sized license for roving grain buyers to carry with them. This way, a farmer can and should ask to verify that a buyer is licensed and bonded and at what level before entering into business deals with them. I know Commissioner Christman has spent many, many hours on this case and on these issues in general. I really appreciate his work and have great respect for his opinions on behalf of producers because he's been one. I know he has other possible solutions in mind. I welcome and look forward to those discussions and to identifying ways that we can improve upon our bonding and licensing programs. So, when combined with the farmer's own good research and business judgment, we can provide a meaningful level of protection in the future and hopefully reduce the likelihood of dramatic losses such as this. This is a choice between two inadequate solutions, but I think our best choice here is to make a decision that is most consistent with our law and current PSC policies and supports the long-term direction of our licensing and bonding program. For these reasons, I thank you for your consideration of my substitute motion and the rationale for it.
We have a motion and a second to entertain a substitute motion. Is there any further discussion?
Well, I guess I would just say that, you know, based on the work session we've had, based on research from cases over the years, I think the law also provides some flexibility for the commission to use its discretion in these cases. And I think this is a perfect case in point where, while Commissioner Fedorchak is correct that there's tragically small amount of money here to go around, I think all the victims in this case that have valid claims are equally deserving of it. So I'm going to vote against the motion.
Is there any further discussion?
Your roll call vote is in order, General.
Yes, it is.
We're voting on the substitute motion.
Yes, we're voting on entertaining the substitute motion.
Okay.
To entertain it.
Do you have a comment here? Make sure we're not.
No, I just said the question is whether to substitute.
Whether to substitute, right. All right, we'll proceed with the roll call. Commissioner Kalk.
Nay.
Commissioner Christman.
Nay.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Aye.
The motion is defeated. We then return to the original motion.
Do we have a motion and a second?
Yep.
Okay.
Clarification, it was seconded?
Okay. Yes, it was seconded. We have a motion and a second on the original motion. Is there any further discussion?
Yeah, I'll go through the case a little bit more, if it's all right, Mr. Chairman, and just background it. Mitchell Feeds Incorporated is a Minnesota business corporation, and they operated as a roving grain buyer in North Dakota, and was licensed on October 28th of 2009. As part of the licensing process, Mitchell Feeds filed a surety bond with the commission in the amount of $70,000, as was mentioned earlier. On February 1st of 2011, a claimant filed a letter for collection of outstanding funds owed to them for grain sold to Mitchell Feeds. On April 14th of 2011, the commission filed an application for appointment as trustee, and the commission also filed an ex parte order to preserve trust assets. On May 5th of 2011, the district court issued an ex parte order to preserve trust assets, prohibiting Mitchell Feeds from selling, transferring, or removing potential assets of the trust fund. On May 20th of 2011, the commission served proper notices on the parties by certified mail and was sent the notices and also sent the notices by regular mail to potential claimants identified by the commission. A notice was published as a legal publication in 10 daily newspapers from May 26th to June 6th of 2011. And on July 20th of 2011, the court issued an order granting Rule 24 intervention of right for 21 of the claimants. On November 21st of 2011, the court issued its order granting Rule 24 intervention for American Federal Bank. Then we're getting into 2012 now. On July 27th of 2012, the court issued an order granting motion for summary judgment of dismissal of the intervener farmers' complaint. On August 14th of 2013, the court issued an order granting motion for leave to withdraw, permitting the withdrawal of Derek Broughton, Lindsay Newsma, and Baumstark Broughton Law Partners as counsel for the intervener claimants. There have been 26 claims totaling slightly less than $1.5 million filed with the commission. The $70,000 bond proceeds are the only assets available to pay valid cash claims. When the bond proceeds are paid over to the commission as trustee, there will be funds available from the trust fund to pay each valid cash claimant approximately 7% of their valid cash claim. The commission recommends that payment for each cash claim be made jointly payable to the claimant and relevant valid lien holders at the time checks are issued. The final amounts to be paid will be determined once court approval is received. The valid cash claims, cash claim amounts recommended for payment by the commission total just slightly over $1 million. Invalid amounts of $463,212.08 include claims for breach of contract, the erroneous use of gross weight rather than net weight, failure to deduct the sunflower promotion fee, etc., or a combination of these reasons. The commission recommends that one non-jurisdictional cash claim in the amount of $6,161 also be denied. Despite the fact that the motion has us filing with Burley County District Court, the court has scheduled a hearing on this matter for March 17, 2014, at 9 o'clock at the Morton County Courthouse in Mandan for interested parties to show cause why the report and recommendation of trustee should not be approved.
Is there any further discussion?
I guess I'll say my piece a little bit here, too. It's interesting because this has been going on for quite some time, and the points that were brought out about bonding levels has certainly been a point of discussion since long before I ever became part of the commission. And I can think as early as the last 2 years, we've had, and before that, numerous discussion with grower groups about raising the bond levels, and a lot of different viewpoints out there, but most of them don't want to raise the bond level because then they have to pay more. And so that this bond level is always going to be a robust discussion in the state of North Dakota, and I think it needs to continue. I'm glad that Commissioner Crisman is on the commission now with, I think, perhaps the strongest background I've had in ag in the commission for quite some time. So I appreciate his work on this, and I also appreciate Commissioner Fedorchuk's strict interpretation of the law, because I think that the way she's laid it out is probably accurate. But when we had the work session and I looked at both these competing viewpoints, I thought, well, let's look at this from a way that we can get to have this legally supportable, to use this as a case that this is an unfortunate incident, that we can use the bond that we are given, this, we're authorized to be trustee, to help cover all the people that are involved in this. So I talked to our general counsel and I said, give me a way that we could have this be supportable with a legal basis that, if questioned, that it would hold. And so basically we kind of went through that just very simple viewpoint that we are entrusted as being trustee. This is a unique and unfortunate circumstance. The $70,000 bond will be maxed out in either case. In this case, I think the best thing for us to do is try to spread it out amongst all those people that were suffered in this loss and use this as lessons learned for as we license roving grain buyers. Make sure we do the once, twice, three, four, five, six times to make sure that they have not done things they shouldn't be doing. Commissioner Fedorchuk's idea about the card, I think, is a very good idea. But in this particular case, I think it's worth taking a look if we can use this as an isolated incident that we're trying to defer some of the losses for everybody, and we'll just see going forward how it all plays out. But we in no way should use this as a basis for future decisions in the commission, because I think this is a very unique circumstance that each set of decisions is based on a unique set of facts. So that's kind of where I came down on this, and I appreciate both my colleagues' work on this, and we'll just see what all plays out.
I think if I can make one more point on, you know, some of the comments that Commissioner Fedorchuk talked about fixing some of the things that are out there that need fixing. One of my goals when I assumed this office just over a year ago and got this portfolio was to work on fixing some of these problems, and really in order to do that and do it well and without doing things that maybe cause other problems down the road, I thought the first priority needs to be to work through and resolve some of these old cases. And of course they still need court approval, but this will be the third and last of the cases that have been around for such a long time. These claimants raised the crops that they did not get paid for when John Hoeven was our governor. And not to connect any blame, but I'm talking about time perspective. You know, that seems like a long time ago in the world of this capital. And yet these farmers have been waiting that long. And I think in pushing through a resolution to these cases that are tough, and yeah, they're not clear black and white decisions that we have to make on numerous issues within each of the cases. I think we've all learned a lot and done a lot of the groundwork for figuring out what changes that we can make and what changes we need to ask the legislature to make. And so I just didn't want that lost, that I agree that we do have things that we need to do here in order to lessen the chances of these insolvencies happening and to minimize the damages when they do happen.
Just to add my comments to this motion, while this isn't my preferred approach, I will be voting in favor of this motion because, A, I want to wrap this up and be in support of that, and B, I wouldn't want a no vote to be suggested that I don't support paying the farmers at all, and so I'll be supporting this motion.
Yeah, I just want to, we were just all three were at the Grayman's Convention, and we had the staff did a great job. Tim and Mike Rowe were there, Sue, and we had a lot of discussion about all kinds of things. But one of the things that Sue coined out coin that I'm going to be adding to my repertoire of statements is, I've been saying since I got here, call before you dig, pipeline safety. Now it's going to be call before you sell, right, Sue? That's the message we're going to get out there. And I mean, it's, I don't mean to make light of it, but people should know who they're doing business with. Call before you sell. Make sure they're bonded. Make sure they've got the right license. That's the message that we have got to get out there to these groups. And it's funny when you talk like at the Grayman's Convention, everybody always says, yeah, we understand. But they'll drive by 20 county small elevators to get this good deal down the road. And then these good deals tend to unravel at some point in time. And so that's where I think the awareness of this is just, I'm glad to see that this is moving up in priorities in different portfolios. And I look forward to getting through this one and not having any in the future. So, but we may.
Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
All right, anything else, Commissioner Christman?
Nothing else.
I thought it was a relatively quick meeting, but I was mistaken. So, good discussion.
Still just a half an hour.
That's right. We're not done yet, Commissioner.
I know.
All right, Commissioner Fedorchak, your portfolio.
I move the Commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in the application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity concerning a 132-mile bidirectional crude oil pipeline in Williams, McKenzie, Stark, and Billings Counties, North Dakota, case number PU-13-901.
Second.
On December 16th of 2013, Bakken Link Pipeline filed an application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity for their 132-mile bidirectional crude oil pipeline and other facilities to be used for the transport of crude oil from Tioga, North Dakota, to a crude oil rail loading facility near Fryeburg, North Dakota. Those interested are invited to comment on the application in writing by March 2nd of 2014. And if deemed appropriate, the Commission can determine this matter without a hearing. This pipeline is a pipeline that the Commission has already provided a route permit and siting certificate for. This is a public convenience and necessity matter. The half of this route, or a little bit more than half of it, is already constructed and in use. And this, their public convenience and necessity is just an additional step they're taking to declare to the public and get our blessing for being a common carrier. So that's all I have on this matter.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Since you're not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
And the last item in my portfolio, I move the Commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in the applications for an amended certificate of corridor compatibility on an amended route permit, an application for waivers of procedures and time schedules concerning the Bakken Oil Express LLC pipeline, a 38-mile crude oil pipeline located in Dunn and Stark Counties, North Dakota, case number PU-13-825.
Second.
This is a project that we issued an order for in at the end of December. It's that pipeline in Dunn and Stark Counties that goes from Kildare to a rail facility outside of Dickinson. In a couple weeks ago, Bakken Oil Express filed a request to modify the order to allow an increase in the pipe diameter from 16 to 20 inches along the last 4 miles of this pipeline. They had secured a contract with another company, let's see, it's Bear Paw or True Oil's, a True Oil pipeline that would feed into this line at the that 4 miles from the end. And so they'd like to get our blessing on expanding the last segment of this pipeline, make it larger to make room for this additional oil. And so this basically notifies the public that we're going to be looking at that matter. And if anybody has concerns, they should let us know by February 20th of 2014. And again, if deemed appropriate, we can determine this matter without a hearing.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
That concludes my portfolio.
All right, thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Christman, any closing thoughts?
I don't.
Julie, any closing thoughts?
Nope.
Okay, I'll just kind of get some highlights for some things coming up to the Commission. Next week, the big day that every day is a big day, but February 6th, we have PHMSA calling in for a potentially two-hour discussion about what PHMSA is doing for regulating intrastate liquid lines in North Dakota. It's a discussion that's been going on throughout the state about what is the right regulatory touch for pipelines, whether they be distribution lines, whether they be gathering lines, whether they be intrastate lines, whether they be interstate lines. So I'm looking forward to that discussion. In that afternoon, the February 6th at 1 o'clock, we have Southwest Power Pool. I believe they're going to actually be here, and they're going to talk about the role the Public Service Commission may/will be taking in Southwest Power Pool as Basin Electric continues down the road of joining that regional transmission organization. It came up as a topic of discussion, quite honestly, yesterday in the siting case. So look forward to those meetings. They may not sound like they're real spicy, but the implications of what Basin joining Southwest Power Pool are very, very big. Implications to ratepayers, implications to reliability. And that's part of the discussion and figuring out our role, just like Jerry is heavily involved in MISO as well as I am, what the commission and commissioner's role in Southwest Power Pool will be. Informal hearing, Cass County Electric and City of Valley City Service Area Agreement, middle part of February. And then the big hearings coming up on the Enbridge pipelines that will be held in Grand Forks, Devil's Lake, and Minot. So other than that, I don't have any other thoughts. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that we could.
I was looking at the the announcements list. The Basin power line through the Kildare battlefield area, January 30th, the work session was canceled.
Yeah, we had it scheduled for, I guess it would be today, and some information came in kind of late, and we wanted to make sure we had it all in there, so we're just going to reschedule that. But my opening comments were that is on our list of priorities, and we've, I believe, now received everything we need to do to start deliberation on it. We've got the draft EIS. We can read through that, and I look forward to that discussion and scheduling that as quick as we can. We just weren't sure we'd have the information, but now we have it. So.
Okay, so you do have the information now? And the February 3rd formal hearing, that relates to that? No, never mind.
That's a different issue.
Yes, sorry about that. I needed to turn a page. The Bakken Oil Express case, can you tell me what is the – okay, the line runs from where to where, and where does the pipeline expand?
The Bakken Oil Express runs from Kildare to a rail facility right outside of Dickinson, so it's about 30-some miles. And the expansion would be on the last 4 miles leading up to the rail facility.
Okay, so it would be in Stark County.
Correct.
Okay. As far as Bakken Link, I'm sorry, but I'm a little puzzled as to why this. I'm puzzled as to why they're asking for a PCNN.
Yeah, we're not sure.
Okay.
So you could call them. From what I've heard and talking with staff, it's not something that's required for them to be a public common carrier. And so I guess I would encourage you to ask them that, and we will be finding that out from them when we move forward on this.
Did you make it clear to them that they didn't have to do this?
Yes.
This is kind of weird, but if someone comes to you and says, we want to do this and they don't have to do it, why do you waste your time on it?
Well, I guess it's something that they can ask for. It's not required of them. It's something they can ask for, and I guess we don't see it as our role to get in the middle of the business's business of knowing their what's driving their decision making. So it's something they can ask for, and we can provide it. We can analyze it and go through the process of granting it if it's appropriate.
Dale, if I could just add to that. I mean, when I read through this, I did the same head scratcher. So, well, if they want to come in and present their stuff in what may be turning out to be an informal, it doesn't mean that we'll act on it. It may just get dismissed after the informal. But if they want to come say their piece, I'm happy to hear why they think it would help them. But I certainly want to know why, so we don't start some kind of precedence where everybody thinks they have to come in. So, but let them say their piece, and if it's something almost like a request for a jurisdictional opinion, is kind of where I maybe relate this loosely.
Well, I was, I mean, this is not a good analogy, but I was thinking about when the North Dakota Supreme Court gets requests for advisory opinions, they refuse them because they say that's not the business that we're in. I mean, I wouldn't think that the business that you're in is granting certificates to companies, whatever their reason might be, that they don't need.
Yeah,
I'd like to hear their arguments, I guess, before I make that determination.
The Mitchell Feeds case, what kind of grain are we talking about?
Sunflower seeds.
Okay. And what's there was discussion of the period of the bond. What was that period?
It was from late, I'll have it for you in a minute. It was late in 2009.
October 10th, I think.
Until 2011.
October 2009 for 2 years beyond that? Is that right?
Yes. October 21st, 2009.
And 2 years.
Well, in the spring of 2011 was when we got the claim and filed for appointment as trustee, so the bond was still in effect then, and so I'm sure they've quit paying on it, but it remains effective.
Okay, and if Commissioner Fedorchuk's motion had prevailed, how would that have changed who was paid and how much? Would it have changed it that much?
Well, it would have... The ones who had their deal before that 2009 date would have been excluded completely, which would have meant that the later claimants would have gone from 7% to about 18%. Those are round percentages, of course.
Okay. So they'd go from getting 7 cents on the dollar to 18 cents on the dollar.
Correct.
And this would have affected if Commissioner Fedorchuk's motion had prevailed, the folks who filed claims for grain that was sold before October 21st of 2009 would have been excluded.
Correct.
Is that right? Do you know how many of those folks there were?
12.
12. And do you know the amount of their claims?
About 600 and some thousand. Hold on, I've got that.
Do you expect this matter to be litigated? I mean, that's a fairly significant change.
Well, that was Dale. That was my question. I talked with our general counsel after the commissioners met for a work session. I asked Alana to give me a strategy that we think would hold if that comes around to it. And if it does, then it'll clarify things. In this case, I think the bond is going to, the max bond amount is going to be exercised either way. And I think that it'll be interesting to see how this plays. But certainly, I looked at all those different possibilities.
But you have basically you're excluding, or you would have excluded, almost two thirds or three quarters of the claims in settling this, and the people who had the valid claims going forward would have gotten more than double the compensation that they're going to get otherwise.
That is.
That's right.
Well, I'm sure it wouldn't be three quarters, but more than half would have been excluded.
I should have said two thirds. I'm sorry, or approximately two thirds. When we talk about increasing the bond requirements, what are we talking about in terms of like money? How much should the bond be, and how much would it cost to obtain a bond like that?
I don't have the numbers in terms of how much the increases would be, but there's a lot of different ways you could look at this. In other states, I think it's a fluctuating number that is reviewed every year. We have a set of figures that was established in law. So if you estimate, like, for example, the roving grain buyer that we licensed today, they estimate that they're going to deal with 50,000 bushels up to 100,000 bushels. So we have a chart that basically says if you have expect to use this much, deal with this much grain, then your bond is $50,000. But it has nothing to do with price. And I think it should have something to do with price. And I also think that there's special circumstances that need to be factored in with some of these specialty crops, the roving grain buyers who are harder to find and don't have a facility. You know, the reality is a lot of the elevators and grain dealers do business very well and are never defaulting. And we don't want to punish them. We want to get at the problem issues. So it's going to take some finesse to figure out what are the best ways to do it. There's a number of different ways. Some of it is the bonding levels, and some of it might be just in how scale tickets are converted and enforcing some of the laws that require with a warehouse or a grain facility that they convert their tickets within 45 days versus allowing them to, you know, stay open for a long period of time. So you'd have fewer people who hadn't been paid if you had an insolvency in doing that. So there's a whole number of different issues, and I think it's premature to say what we would set the bonding levels at under what conditions, but we're going to look at it.
But to add to that before you go to your next question, I think one of the keys that I personally am looking at is that I don't know if these bond amounts need to necessarily be the same for everybody. You know, a facility that's been in business for decades and is very stable financially and has proven that perhaps should be looked at differently than someone who's just come in that we're not very familiar with and is in their first year of business. Perhaps we need a different requirement for new players until they're established and have proven themselves. Julie mentioned the roving grain buyers, and you know one of the problem there is that when we're doing a trust fund like this, you know you would typically hope in the case of a grain elevator that you've got not only your bond but that you get in there early enough to capture some grain to add to that trust fund. But in the case of a roving grain buyer, by definition, there's probably not going to be any grain. So, you know, it certainly begs the question, should roving grain buyers at the same level of purchasing be bonded higher than a facility-type elevator?
Yeah, I guess that was going to
processors are kind of the same thing. Instead of the grain sitting there that we can capture, if they've got it partially processed, then we can't add that to the trust fund. So a lot of different options that are being explored now that we have these old cases closer to wrap up.
Throw in my two cents, too. The bonding level, there's no amount of bond that you're going to put out there to protect people from bad decisions. And that's some of the reality of it. When I talk with the grain elevator managers, a couple things always come to mind in these insolvencies for me. If you've got, you know, my father-in-law was a grain elevator manager for 40 years. And he says, if you got good elevator managers, you got a good business. So you go back to the people who manage the elevators. When they don't convert their tickets in the 45 days they're supposed to, they're setting things up. So I think the 45-day convert has got to be a priority of the commission no matter what we do. We've heard back from at the Grainman's Convention, some folks don't want to do it in 45 days because of tax reasons. Well, then you know what? Then you need to get and change the law. But we're going to be having the discussion, the three of us, about with Tim and Mike, how tight we want to do in that 45 days because that's what the law says. And so I think that's one of those – this is a discussion, like I said before, is going to continue. But if you've got good managers that are doing the practices they're supposed to do, you're going to reduce the risk of all these things. And it comes back to individual managers doing what they're supposed to do. And the grower groups, Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, they need to take some ownership in this too because when we get them together – we want to fix this, but we don't support raising the bonds. But yet they're upset. It's just this circle that goes around and around.
What I'm trying to get at here is that okay, first of all, you say, you know, call before you buy, blah blah blah, and you just mentioned that, you know, farmers don't want to, you know, convert their scale tickets after 45 days for tax.
Some don't.
Well, some of them don't. Okay, so what you're basically doing by your decision here is you're enabling that behavior, aren't you? I mean, you're saying, oh, okay, you know, it doesn't matter whether the bond was in effect. You know, you were dealing with an unlicensed grain buyer, but that's okay. We'll protect you, even though you're a schmuck and didn't check as you should. And you're enabling that behavior while you're saying that behavior shouldn't happen. And I'm trying to work my way through
that. I think it just goes back for me personally. It's a unfortunate incident that's isolated that should not be used for any future decisions, and we now have a commission that is going to move this issue and tackle it head on, where I've not sensed the resolve to deal with this in previous commissions. to be frank. I do not view this decision today as being applied in the future at all. It's trying to get through this unfortunate situation with a unique set of facts. That's the way I view this one today.
Dale, I would strongly disagree with any characterization of those farmers being schmucks for dealing with us with that.
For dealing
with Mitchell.
With unlicensed buyer.
This commission licensed them after that and did not detect that there were these problems. The bonding company, who we rely to a large extent upon, that, you know, they're the ones who are putting their resources out, assuring the customers of this company's background, they, you know, did whatever background they do. They didn't catch that there were these issues. And so that a farmer wouldn't have known that, I think it would be very unfair to characterize them in that way.
Well, it is true, though, that these folks sold to an unlicensed.
That is true.
Okay.
I think it does go back to this is clearly a partnership. I mean, I think it's more consistent with, you know, law and our policies to have just provided the proceeds to the people who were covered by the bond. But the fact is, it was cold comfort for even those people because the bond only provided $70,000. So they got, you know, they could have had the chance of getting 18% of their bonds, of their losses. So they did it right and still lost a lot of money. And so even if more people had done that and had dealt with them during the bonding period, they still would have lost a lot of money, which then that comes back to what we can do to reduce the likelihood of that happening in the future.
I was interested in exploring Commissioner Crisman's point a bit first of all, when you talk about converting scale tickets in 45 days, what that means is you essentially take payment for the grain that you sold the person within 45 days, right?
You take payment or sign a contract.
Okay.
A credit sale contract that's valid.
Do credit sale contracts have any role here? Does the credit sale indemnity fund cover any of these losses?
Not in this case, but, you know, had one of these claimants had a valid credit sale contract, they would be getting 80% now instead of 7.
And were there, how many of these, do you know how many of these folks didn't take payment after 45 days and also did not have a contract?
See, 45 days doesn't apply in the roving because that's only for a facility-based.
Okay.
Roving grain buyers, they signed a contract that they handed over title to their grain and they were to be paid within 10 days.
Okay, and some of
so it was 10 days in this case.
All right. Okay, but did some of them consent to leave their to delay receiving payment beyond 10 days? I guess that's what I'm getting.
I don't believe so. They handed over title of the grain immediately.
Okay,
and because there's no facility for the grain to be held in, so it's a buy sell. On the spot, here it is, and you're supposed to be paid within 10 days.
Yeah, I was interested in Commissioner Crisman's idea about the longer standing buyers maybe having a different bond requirement than those that are just coming into the game. Is that right?
Yeah.
It's
a possibility that I'm certainly exploring, that after people have proven themselves for a number of years and seem very stabilized, that perhaps their bond amounts can even go down.
Did they? You mentioned that the only assets were the 70K, the bond. Does a roving grain buyer, are there other assets that the buyer can be, are there other assets you can seize, for example, like their truck or their office building if they have one or anything?
Not that we can seize.
Okay.
And I think it's one of the good things about getting this moved along and getting this settled so that these claimants know where they're at, where they stand. And I'm certainly not a lawyer, but I don't see any reason why they can't go after Mitchell personally for their losses, but we don't have a role in capturing any other assets than the commodity and the bond.
Do you have any idea why the buyer became insolvent?
Not that I could put certainty on. You know, the markets fluctuated a lot. They had agreements to buy all these sunflowers for pretty high dollar amounts, and the markets dropped a lot. But you know, whether that's the whole reason or anything, that's just I guess looking at the reality and making an assumption.
Really. Well, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, like the bond company didn't detect this, and plus the commission licensed this buyer and they were okay with it. I was just wondering if there was some kind of inherent flaw in the business other than the normal dynamics of the business that caused the insolvency. Am I making any sense here?
Seemed to be paying a lot because he was getting all these deals. And, you know, you look at this list and they're from a pretty wide geographic area. And so I guess my assumption is that Mitchell was paying better than the other alternatives where these people could have sold their sunflowers. And, you know, I guess if I was the bonding company and was exposing myself to this immediate liability, I'd have kind of wondered why I was getting all this business from all over the state. But they didn't, like I say, they didn't catch it either. So,
and Commissioner Fedorchuk, you mentioned you know, possible changes in bonding. Did I understand you correctly? Is it one of the things that could be considered is bonding based on the value of the business this company's doing rather than just a flat amount?
I think we have to look at that. Other states have bonds that are set in that way. And again, but I strongly agree with Commissioner Christman in that the bonding levels for companies that are proven and been here a long time and aren't causing any problems, they need to be credited for that. So there needs to be, you know, I don't think you could go straight on that, or maybe that's just the criteria you use for the roving grain buyers to set the higher level because they aren't going to have any assets to recover in addition to the bond.
Yeah, I just wanted to revisit an earlier question. I mentioned, you know, I shouldn't have used the word schmuck, so it's just something that came into my mind. But I would like you to address the idea that because you're paying people who did business knowingly with a unlicensed grain buyer, that you are in fact enabling the kind of behavior that you profess to discourage.
That's exactly why I had an alternative motion.
Well, I think I answered the question, Dale. It's the unfortunate situation, an extraordinary.
Well, you also said that I thought was really interesting. You said, I looked at this, and Commissioner Fedorchuk's probably right, but you went against. I couldn't figure that one out.
Well, I didn't. I don't know exactly what the word I said was.
Is that I can quote it to you here if I find my.
I looked at is that the case that she made is a strict interpretation of the law, and I don't disagree with that. When I talk with our general counsel,
probably accurate. Yeah, that's what
I don't disagree with that. But I said the extension of it is, I did talk to our general counsel and I said, you know what? For this unique set of facts, find me a way that we can support legally that gets us to helping everybody get a little. And so that's what I came down with. So I see that as a, you know what? This is a untested area, and we'll see where it goes. But it doesn't change what we need to do. And that's, I think, what the focus area for us, all three of us, needs to be focused on this as a commission. And I'm absolutely positive that we've got a portfolio holder now that's going to do that.
And I think, and I mentioned it earlier, that the law gives us some discretion. And that's what I feel like we're using here. And part of that discretion, for me personally, is making a bit of a correlation between a roving grain buyer case and a more traditional elevator case. And in more traditional elevator cases, the court in Grabansky talked about that you needed to be a receipt holder during the time the bond was in effect. To me, using my discretion, if you didn't get paid for a deal, and later on there's a bond in effect, bonding that company. You haven't been paid. I feel you're still a receipt holder.
Okay, because you have a piece of paper in your hand saying
you're still owed.
Okay.
Just because the time clock passed the moment that that was supposed to be paid, I feel you're still owed. And so that is part of the discretion that, that I'm weighing into this case on, with my vote.
All right.
And if we do get into litigation, then we'll have a closed meeting and we'll talk about our legal strategy. And we've thrown out lots of different things here that might come to play, but that's the way it works.
Well, what Commissioner Christman said I thought was pretty good. That's
why he supported the motion.
What do you all how are you going to respond to the natural gas crisis, if I could use the term, last weekend with a Canadian pipeline explosion?
Well, I just walked through the process of Saturday morning. We started getting emails, phone calls from Mark Nisbet and Dave Cedarquist, you know, letting us know what's going on. So I think all three of us tracked the issue and offered any assistance that we could. Basically, I think that the challenge is going to be is try to figure out what the new norm is for natural gas supply that Xcel has to deliver, and then try to figure out areas of vulnerability. I mean, when you lose a line the size that they did, that's one of those things kind of that it's really hard to model and plan for that. But I know that 2-3 years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, Xcel came to us being very concerned about their gas limitations in Fargo, and they made some changes in their Fargo infrastructure to get more gas into Fargo. I think the discussion that needs to take place now is how tight are the margins in Fargo, Grand Forks area on a normal, you know, peak day, if you will, and then try to figure out if there needs to be more supply coming into that area. There's going to be, I would bet, more gas lines coming from western North Dakota to eastern North Dakota that'll give more redundancy in that system. But for me, I think it's have the discussion with Xcel, figure out how close they're running their margins. And if they need to bring in more, then they need to do that, just like we do for electricity, trying to figure out what we have for redundancy, reliability, similar type discussions. But I thought, I'm very critical of Xcel on occasion, but I thought they did an extraordinarily nice job on this. They handled it throughout the North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin region. They kept everyone informed. They stayed ahead of it. And even MDU had via Great Plains did the same kind of work down in the Wapton area. So I thought they did a great job, but there is some lessons learned, I think, on ways we can get more gas in the area in times of crisis.
And just to add, you pretty much covered it all. And at the end, you brought in Great Plains. But earlier on, when you mentioned Mark and Dave with Xcel, Garrett at Great Plains was also updating us throughout the weekend.
Just to add to that, I have been in discussions with Xcel this week, and we'll be visiting with them tomorrow to kind of get some of that data and start better understanding what redundancies exist and how we might help urge more. So I should be chatting with them tomorrow, and if I have a really good conversation and set up something on our agenda for the commission as a whole.
I guess there's been a lot of conversation amongst the commissioners over the years about redundancy in electric supply, but I don't really recall a lot of conversation about redundancy in natural gas.
There wasn't. In my time here, the only once we had the discussion, Xcel came to us and said they were concerned about meeting their winter load with gas, and they made some modifications in the Fargo area that they felt would help that out. So the discussion will shift to gas now. And I think the larger discussion is, as we transition to more of a natural gas society, how much more strain is that going to put on the existing infrastructure, and what is the new norm of natural gas delivery that's going to be required throughout the whole region? It's going to be interesting discussion. But we need to be right in the middle of it, because that is definitely one of our jurisdictional areas.
I thought throughout the weekend, just one of my thoughts, and as kind of helplessly over the weekend, thought about those people down there that were, you know, suffering through having their thermostat set at 60 degrees, including my sister who's in Grand Forks. I couldn't help but think about the Basin Electric power line going up to northwest North Dakota and the discussion that we had throughout the last almost a year. And, you know, there's people who feel that line should just go along Highway 200 like the other line. And so this really emphasized Basin's point about, no, we need them in different places for redundancy purposes. So all these different subjects kind of come around circle and come together too.
They sure do. It sure emphasizes to everyone. I mean, we have these ideas about what we want, where we want it, whether there should be additional pipelines, whether there shouldn't. But when all is said and done, we're all very dependent on this technology, the electric system, the gas system. Our lives depend on it. And so we have to be really realistic, I think, in how we analyze the development and support it so that we can maintain service to our communities in a safe, reliable, and affordable way.
All right. Dave, you have anything for us that we haven't hit on?
The only thing is you did mention you were going to do a little follow-up on the symposium you had with EPA. Just wanted to get a clarification of what kind of comments are you looking at filing?
Well, I think that, and this is just me speaking without having the discussion with my colleagues, but we use the session, the symposium, to gather information from the EPA about what the actual requirements are. We had an expert from Rice University, former undersecretary at Department of Energy, talked about the technology available. We had the investor owns talk about the impacts to rates. So take all that information and spool it as to what the effects to North Dakota consumers would be, get that to the EPA with our concerns, and try to give them what we would consider a path forward on this. And then I think get to where the commission is, what we feel exactly on these CO2 rules, get that in a document, and then get that to as many people as we can that can influence what the EPA and the current administration do. But we heard 45% increase in rates during the symposium, and that was a shocking number. And that's what the consumers need to understand, because whether you do this now, there's a technology available. I don't think the technology is available. I have said that I do think capturing CO2 at some point in time for oil recovery, not a bad idea. But that's what I guess I'm envisioning, is to put this in a document that becomes the commission official filing to the EPA. If we can get other states to join in with us and other agencies, I think it adds weight to the filing.
You mentioned at the symposium, and I was not there when you did, because that's why I'm asking the question, about the construction of a certain plant. Is it like an experimental carbon capture type plant that you'd like to see?
I was down in Kemper, Mississippi, and viewed the plant down there that was built as a reaction to the hurricane. Basically, the Mississippi PSC Southern Company is a major player. Department of Energy got together, and they opened up. They're in the process of building a brand-new state-of-the-art burning lignite coal, capturing the CO2 for oil recovery to go down to Louisiana. They're going to produce a lot of power. And right now it's very, very expensive. They're up to like $3 billion. But the PSC of Mississippi, as well as the company and DOE, played a role in that. And my role is on the Clean Coal Committee for NARUC. They're looking for more test sites to do this. So I've had a limited discussion with the delegation about maybe North Dakota could be a test site for the next generation of this type of CO2 capture. And so we've got the lignite here. We've got the enhanced oil recovery ability. We've got the EERC, which has been doing this for decades. We've got two senators, one on each side of the aisle. I think this is something that I know I'll be discussing inside my neighborhood chains, but inside of here, you know, if we could find a way to put something like this together, I think that'd be a win-win for everybody. And given the backdrop, we need 2 gigawatts of power in western North Dakota. So, all right, anything else, gentlemen? Okay, anything else for the good of the order? All right, we'll go ahead and close the general meeting, and we'll start at 11.